they should be liable if the landowner couldn't pay those expenses. And so this is just a little provision that opts the counties out if they get into that situation.
Madam Chair.
Representative Parkinson.
Not to be argumentative or anything, but it would appear to me if a county isn't enforcing its ordinances and doing its duties, that they ought to have to pay part of the costs. Even if you are from Marion County.
Representative Parkinson, it's just my understanding that in some of the counties, the DA's office has got to prioritize his workload. And to the local farmers, this may be a critical issue, and the county should certainly defend it, but the DA is not able to represent the county, and because the county does not show up, and if the landowner is not in a position to pay the assigned costs, then the county would get stuck with it, and we're trying to say that under those circumstances, the county shouldn't have to pay.
Madam Chair.
Representative Parkinson, Representative Hill.
What if the person bringing the suit is indigent? Could an indigent person bring suit?
If they don't have money to hire an attorney, it'd be highly unlikely unless legal aid takes up.
Couldn't an attorney take it on a contingency basis?
I don't think this is the kind of case you'd make any money on.
I think from what you said, what Fred's comment would go with deleting the all, however, if the court and so forth. Is that true? But my sympathies are to take that out of there. Is that unreasonable? Is anybody else that's willing to agree to take out, however, if the court allows the plaintiff reasonable attorney's fees and so forth, and cause the counties to act more responsibly in granting the hardship? If they know that if they act injudiciously and improperly, that they might be responsible for some of the costs if indeed it's reimbursed.
That Representative Priestley, let me and I don't know what's happened in all the counties. I think one of the problems has been that they have acted in a proper manner when they've allowed the hardship to occur. It is once they've allowed that to occur and it's legitimate. Maybe they bought it for a parent who was elderly and the parent died and they've left the trailer there and they've rented it out. It's the misuse sort of after the fact as opposed to misusing when they allow the hardship case. That's my understanding where the problems arisen and where the enforcement has been difficult.
Madam Chair.
Representative Parker.
Maybe we could treat this a little bit like the golf course provision and leave it in until we decide whether we want to pass the bill or kill the bill.
Anything else on this page? Is there any objection?
Yes, on this page there is, but not there.
All right, in section 2, is there any objection to adopting that? So ordered. Representative Parkinson, you have some other problems?
Line 16, I guess we're going down into that now. I read line 14, it says public and private schools, including all buildings, essential too. And then I went down to the next line, it says churches. And the thought occurred to me that if you had a rural, isolated church, that it would probably be very reasonable to assume that maybe a parsonage would also be located on the property, if for no other reason than to watch and protect the church. And it looks like that ought to be a permitted use. In other words, if you allow a church, you ought to allow a preacher to live next to his church without going through a goal exception. That doesn't make sense.
What currently happens then? Not being going to a rural church, what currently happens in that situation? Anybody know?
Madam Chairman, members of the committee, I guess most planning directors, if they were presented with the issue of a church wanting a parsonage, would pick up the phone and call Ron. And Ron would say, well, we got a little bit of flexibility in that area. If you have typically in your other zones considered parsonages as an accessory use to a church, You might want to do it, but then you might have second thoughts about whether or not you were approving an on-farm dwelling in an EFU zone, and make some comments about whether or not you ought to look at some of those criteria. And then we get into the question of whether you've got to disqualify the ground from farm use and a lot of other things, and we deal with that every day.
My understanding is we don't have, that's not a problem.
What about under this bill?
Well, this is the current language. This is current law, Representative Parkinson.
Madam Chairman, I guess I would say we don't have a problem if Ron Eber is not upset that some of the counties might allow parsonages as part of churches.
Madam Chair, could we allow a church or a parsonage for one church under present regulations and not allow a parsonage for another church? I guess that's my question.
I guess the planning director's relationship with
that church?
Well, I shouldn't have said that. I apologize.
I mean, Madam Chairman, I'll clarify that point. Counties are consistent within the county, so that we wouldn't discriminate between a church in an EFU zone in one area versus another area because of the denomination or something. We would adopt a consistent approach one way or another.
Elizabeth, you want to? That's
fine. Even though we're a bingo church?
Is there anything anybody wants to do with this?
Yes.
Page 5.
Madam Chair.
You still on churches? Are you going on beyond churches? I wanted to ask if the people support this want to have churches, say, from Portland locating out in a rural, or whether we ought to not limit the churches established in exclusive farm use zones to be serving the community. I mean, only.
We could all get around that.
That'd be my preference. Is there support to limit that?
Any other that people want to discuss on page 5, Representative Van Loon?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Lines 18 and 19, I really need to know the effect of that. I think it may be something, and I assume that this is current law.
Yes, it is current law.
18 and 19?
Yes.
That has been amended in 2295.
Would you tell us what's happened, please?
It's been amended to accept out transmission towers over 200 feet. What they've done in 2295 is they've added two provisions, one saying that cities and one saying that counties may allow transmission towers over 200 feet, when it's over 200 feet, as a conditional use in any zone. Okay, this is a permitted use here. And then in accord with that, because there has been some interpretation of utility facilities as including transmission towers, this section would then read utilities facilities necessary for public service except transmission towers over 200 feet and commercial facilities for the purpose of. So they have switched, no longer are utility are transmission towers over 200 feet a permitted use. They are only a conditional use. Under 200 feet, they are not allowed.
Okay. Was that controversial on the other side? I mean, was there any problem with that?
I honestly don't know if it was controversial.
Okay. My problem with this language was just to make sure that that Lacombe Irrigation District could sell its power. And this language seemed to prohibit that.
Conditional use,
yeah.
That's what you're telling me, Elizabeth, but they can sell their power then the way you've done it in 2295.
2295, it wouldn't affect that.
It would make, they could go ahead and.
Well, this says accept commercial facilities for the purpose of generating power for public use by sale, so that would not be a permitted use and under existing law.
But it could be a conditional use. Yeah. Wait, you've lost me.
Well,
yeah. No, you're on.
No, I don't know whether it's sitting here as a conditional use or not.
Page 7, line 20.
Okay, yeah, it's a conditional use in an EFU zone.
Okay.
Madam Chair?
I just didn't want to get them there and then have them not able to do what they were all bones and everything.
Is that right?
That's what it is.
Any problems?
Specific side?
Next page, page six. Any problems on page six?
It's about middle.
Line 21, I need some explanation on this.
Line 21. Dick or Elizabeth or both or whoever's the one correct?
Hi.
Director?
I do.
Okay. Elizabeth, you can come up too.
I didn't hear what the question was, I'm afraid.
We're now on page six, lines 21 and 22.
Dr. McPherson, this is the area where we started with our tests. And the one on line 21, of course, is the one that Gibby is not smaller than the average farmer woodlot in the county. And that is where you go to your tables, and that we have those tables. We could show you those tables as to what they do. It isn't too clear. We've had some discussions about whether we ought to clarify this language, however, to be sure which table you go to, because there are three general tables that the census has provided. One of these would be for the average for each crop, where that is the where the farmer himself lists it as the major crop that he grows. We think that is probably the appropriate table to be going to. There's another table which simply lists it with all the farms that have made $2,500. Both of these tables are divided out for those farms that make $2,500, but does not list it by the major crop. So we have those figures, and I think we could provide you with data which would make it a little more explicit, because since this was written, we found that you could go to the wrong table, and so that one county would be using one table, one county would be using another.
What language, what table would you use, or what language would you...
I would have to get Dick Benner to suggest the actual language on that, okay. But he has promised me that he could give it to Beth one of them very quickly, so that we can give you that, so you know which table we're actually going to when we measure that average income in that table, which lists only those farms that make $2,500 in crops or livestock.
Representative Anderson.
I guess I need some estimates of what you're running test cases. On line 20, you can say 20 acres or more, how this would affect that. Are you in some areas running this up to 80 acres? Are you reducing the 10 acres in some cases if you don't meet the test? Where are we?
Representative Anderson, you'll find, and this is the one case where I think that now you find our side arguing for some statewide flexibility, because it varies tremendously the area of the state that you're in. I have not looked at it for a number of different counties, but I have looked at it, and I have the table in front of me for Washington County. And you find if you go to the table there, for the different kinds of crops, there is quite a little difference between the figures that you get, depending on whether you're going to strawberries or whether you're going to grain. Or my own happens to be dairy, and I find that the average in Washington County for dairy farms happens to be 200 acres. Well, that's quite large, but you go down to tree fruits and nuts, and you find that if you take the average for all the land that is in those farms that make $2,500 and that grow fruits or nuts, the figure is listed as 76 acres. However, if you turn to the person who within that table is going to grow grapes, the figure that you would pick out would be 22 acres. So that's the kind of thing that you're up against when you get to looking at these tables, is that on the tree fruits and nuts, the berries and this kind of things, you get to quite small acres. Now let me remind you that if you come out with less than 20 acres, you still go to the bottom of the table and deal with the figures for $10,000 gross income rather than with a table. But for any figure over 20 acres, this would be the controlling figure for whether that would get an automatic house on that as a farm.
Thank you. Would this override my county 70 acre minimum?
No, your county has, it goes to the very top of this table, and your county apparently is one that has an acreage, a minimum lot size. And the first part of the test, which you've already been over, allows them to use that test where those counties that have it. This really only applies to those counties that do not have a minimum acreage size in their ordinance.
Let me try to explain. If the county which you live has a minimum lot size, you would get a farm dwelling under G. On page 6, the top of the page.
They have a minimum lot size.
Look under page 6, lines 1, 2, 3, and 4. If the county has a minimum lot size, you get a farm dwelling on it.
Absolutely correct.
If the county does not have a minimum lot size, then you drop down to line 20, that it has to be 20 or more acres, and that it is not smaller than the average farmer woodlot in the county producing at least 2,500 in gross annual income from crops, livestock, or forest products, etc., and use to arrive at that, you use the language from the U.S. Census, and we'll have to specify which table. If that lot is less than 20 acres and you want to, and it's for a farm and you want a dwelling on it, then you drop down to lines 24, 25, 26, 27 on page 6, and line 1 through 5 on page 7. So you've got to get a farm dwelling, you can go at it three different ways. Representative Parkinson.
The way I read this, and I'm probably reading it wrong, is that anything under 20 acres could not qualify as a farm. Because the qualifier to start with says it consists of 20 or more acres and.
No, yes, and refers to Big B. Okay? Then you drop down.
But to start with, it has to be 20 acres or more, does it not?
No. Consists of 20 more acres and then you read line 21 and 22.
Unless
those two go together.
Unless you could not, if you have a, does any county have a minimum lot size smaller than 20 acres?
Representative Parkinson, let me try to explain. Okay, line 1 through 4 is by itself.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, if you've got a minimum lot size in your county, you're okay there.
What's the minimum lot size? Is there any minimum 20 acres? Is that a...
No.
No.
Every
yes,
county varies.
Have 20 acres.
Okay, every county varies.
Lynn is 40, Washington 20, Douglas is 70,
okay,
so on.
Okay, I understand.
Okay, now wait. Now let's go to the next section that
Lynn
I think
county's 40.
This
time.
Committee needs to understand. You drop down to line 20 through 23. Line 20 consists of 20 more acres and mm-hmm. is not smaller than the average size. That's one section, okay?
Okay, but it has to be 20 acres.
Mm-hmm. Under that portion.
Okay.
Now you go to the next portion.
Okay.
If it's not 20 acres, and maybe we should say that, if it's not 20 acres, or if it's smaller than the average farmer woodlot, right. If it's either one of those, if it's smaller than the average farm or woodlot in the county, and it can, or it consists of less than 20 acres, either one of those, you drop down to sub B. You start there and you go up to page 7, and in this one, as soon as you produce 10,000 in annual gross income in 2 consecutive years, you get a farm dwelling. Or if it's planted in perennials or trees capable of producing upon harvest an average of at least $10,000 in annual gross income, you get a dwelling. So if it's smaller than that average size, or it's smaller than 20 acres, you then have to prove that you truly are farming it before you get a dwelling on it.
I got you. Thank you.
Okay. Representative Hill, then Representative Anderson.
On line 21, page 6, we've got average farm or woodlot. Now, earlier testimony indicated that the U.S. Census uses the figure of $20,000 gross income to define a farm. Is that correct?
$2,500.
$2,500.
To do what?
That's what that figure
defines. That's what the figure, that doesn't really define anything, except that's how they've broken it out. You can, by paying money, get them to break it out in a different way, but that's what they've already provided us.
So, for determining the average farm or woodlot in the county, a farm would be defined as that $2,500. A farm that produces $2,500 according to the census. You just look in the census, has the number of farms, correct?
Has the number of farms, the acreage, the crops that grew, everything about
them. So the county doesn't have to do any work at all. They just pull it right up.
That is correct. They
Representative Anderson.
Page line 4, we have B, $10,000 in gross income. And there are a good many perennials, grapes. Mm-hmm. Nursery crops that produce up to $3,000 an acre. And I guess we're going to say there that if you have 4 acres, you're entitled to a dwelling. Is that the way I read it? Mm-hmm.
That would be correct. If you're 4 acres, if your 4 acres produced, capable of producing 10,000, you get a lot of house on it.
Great.
Now,
but there's an and on line 2.
And on line 2.
That's the test that you talked about yesterday about changing to clarify what of it, which parts of it apply to farms and which apply to woodlots.
Yes, and,
so
and
that
you were going to help clarify that.
Years immediately prior.
Yes.
Madam Chair. Sorry, but I'm not quite with you.
Well, on page 7, lines 1 through 5, what Elizabeth was talking about and I think what Representative Trahern brought up is you need to clarify which is the farm and which is the
woodlot test.
Which is the woodlot, and that is an annual gross farm income, which would include those perennials too, as opposed to a woodlot. If you were a nurseryman or a nursery person or a grape grower.
Yeah. Yesterday
on line 2, though, doesn't that and have the third word in? Doesn't it have to be changed to an or?
That whole thing will be broken out into two different tests so that they won't
relate.
It has to be reworked,
that whole section. Elizabeth, did you want to finish?
The only thing that's left is I don't think it was decided yesterday or whether you, what 2 consecutive years you wanted to use. Did we decide whether it was going to be any 2 consecutive years, or it was going to just be the 2 consecutive years before the year the application was made, or 3 out of the 5 as we have earlier, whatever.
Hector?
I would be glad to suggest some language there that
Why?
I think would take care of one of the concerns that I've had about this section. In any 2 consecutive calendar years, let's tie it to calendar years, within the 3 years prior to the application. So you've got 3 years and you pick 2 years out of those. But they got to be consecutive, and the reason for that consecutive is that it's so easy for farmers to carry income over from 1 year to another on a gross income type basis, and so they could pile their income up. Consecutive years means that they can't, because they obviously are going to have in 2 years, you can't carry it forward that much. So I'm suggesting that you do it in calendar years and that you do it in 2 out of 3 prior to the application. The problem we have with the language, the way it's in the draft, is that you go back to 1958, or you know, somebody said they had a tremendous crop year sometime completely in the past, which has no relevance to what's happening at the time. And I would like to a little further explain how I think this test works, but I think there's some misunderstanding on the $10,000 and just who gets it and how they apply it. If you're ready for that, I'd be glad to do that, Chair Hooter. The thing that you have to remember is this is not tied to the operator, this is tied to the parcel. That means that the history of that parcel before the person wants to build his house is important if it shows that he could build a house. I can easily see that a number of times that the person who's going to sell the property is going to have qualified that land already if it's a reasonable sized parcel by this $10,000 rule, because he can, if he has grown, say, wheat, and it's a large enough parcel of land that it would have qualified with the kind of a crop that he has grown, he is qualified for the dwelling, and then he sells it to the person who's actually going to build the house. This means that you really have sort of another lot of record, and when we've talked a lot about tightening up the EFU zone, and I look on this thing, and when the Senate took the 20,000 and knocked it down to 10, they made it rather wide open, because very minimum types of endeavors out there would give you the $10,000 gross that you need to qualify to get that farm home. And there is one very obvious subterfuge that I can see that I think this committee ought to consider plugging at this point, and that is the person who buys livestock, moves it onto the property, and maybe pastures them for a week to 3 months, takes them off, sells them, comes back with a sales slip for those livestock, and says, okay, my farm grossed over $10,000, I'm therefore entitled to build a home on it. Now, the answer to that one is that in the case of livestock, we need to say that we should deduct the purchase price of livestock. This is the reason that I know that this particular type of thing goes on, is that they're now qualifying for farm use assessment based on two head of livestock. They bring them on, walk them through the property and take them off, and then the assessor has to give them, say that they've made their $500. So it is something that has been used in a way that I do not approve of already, and I think it would be a good time at this point to see that that doesn't happen with this particular piece of legislation.
Are there any further questions? Any motions? Representative Priestley.
I have this fetish, maybe Hector could speak to it here, between median and average. The data, I wish I could see some of this data if it's so readily available. I guess we had one sheet, didn't we? Is this calculated? Could we go to median? Because my concern is that you have, say, in a woodlot, which I could understand maybe a little more readily, a huge tract of Weyerhaeuser, and they have, say, 5,000 acres. And then you have, say, a bunch of people growing Christmas trees on maybe 20 or 30 acres or 50 acres. Well, average is going to be quite a bit above, skewed above the median. So I'm just...
Representative Priestley, I don't know that I can speak to exactly what you're talking about, but I can assure you that I have before me the Census of Agriculture for Marion County, and the average woodlot in Marion County was 47 acres. So this is the part of those farms. This is all part of farms, remember. We're not talking about forestry. When you get into Weyerhaeuser, you're talking about something altogether different because they're not in an EFU zone. So I don't think that's a particular concern, and the acreages that I see coming out of the tests here wouldn't indicate that there was a particular problem. They give us an averages, and it would be, I would think it might be difficult to regenerate the data to give you a median as opposed to an average.
Representative Hill.
In the figures before you, do they explain what the average means? I think that's Representative Priestley's question. Is it
they tell us how they arrive at it. They simply take the number of acres that are reported in woodlots, they divide it by the number of farms that had woodlots, that is your figure that they come up with. Yeah.
Manatee.
Representative Bamber.
If we are through that right then, let's have Russ Nippon give his response to this section.
Okay, Russ, do you want to come up? We're going to caucus in 4 minutes, so we'll have to be out. We will go tonight until we finish this bill.
Madam Chairman and members of the committee, I think some of the questions that Representative Priestley asked may be answered in my testimony. I'd like to start by saying that I think it's important for the committee to understand that most of the acknowledged counties have no minimum lot size in their EFU zone. So when you look at this section of the bill and it says if you have a minimum lot size you can give somebody a dwelling, you're talking about less than a majority of the counties that have already come through the process. That means that a number of counties are going to have to use a different procedure because they cannot grant those dwellings outright. I'd like to explain to you what the impact on that process is in Marion County, and then you can extrapolate from that as to how it might apply to your county. We would then, because we have no minimum lot size, have to drop down to the section that you've been discussing and take a look at whether or not the parcel is 20 or more acres in size, and then get this information from the census out that's been requested or been stipulated here in the Act. and I'd like to just give you some statistics for Marion County. Recalling that in the next test, anything that's planted in perennials that will generate $10,000 in income is entitled to a dwelling. I took the 11 groups that are listed in the census, and there were three of them that appeared to me the kinds of perennials that the bill was addressing, and so I took those out of my calculations so that we wouldn't get the information skewed. Dealing with the other eight categories, in Marion County there were 1,292 farms that had an average of over $2,500 in income.
How many?
1,292. Of those, 862, or 66.7%, are under the average for that particular group. Let me give you a couple of examples. Cash grains, for example, we had 149 acres was the average farm size for a farm that was predominantly cash grains. 75 out of 122 in Marion County were below that average. So if those properties today were to come in and ask for a dwelling, I would have to say you're over 20 acres, but you don't meet the average test of 149 acres.
Madam Chair.
So we cannot approve a dwelling.